Hi, friends. I'm Pearson Cross. Welcome to By the Beltway. Today, we are joined by Ms. Angie Drobnik-Holen, who is the editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. PolitiFact is a site, a website and an organization that fact-checks the presidency, Congress, political campaigns. Ms. Holen has been a reporter on a team that won a Pulitzer Prize, so she's a Pulitzer Prize winner for national reporting. She has a master's degree, too, actually, one in journalism from Columbia University and the other in library science from the University of South Florida. She attended Texas Austin, and then, interestingly for our listeners, she is a native of Louisiana and, in fact, attended the Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts before going on to her illustrious journalism career. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. So most people, I would think, and that probably includes me in that group, have a very limited understanding of PolitiFact or what you do as editor-in-chief. So if you could tell us a little bit about what you do and what PolitiFact's mission is and those sorts of things.
Sure. PolitiFact started at a daily newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times newspaper, and it was an election year project that was devoted to fact-checking. So this was back in 2007. As people may remember, President George W. Bush had finished his two terms, and his vice president, Dick Cheney, was not running. So we had two primary contests for the Democrats and the Republicans. And it was kind of an interesting time in journalism because it was the early days of the internet. So a bunch of us, led by Bill Adair, who were print journalists, said, let's do something on the web that's going to focus on fact-checking the candidates. So we won't concentrate on following them on the campaign bus or just writing down everything they say. We're going to watch their speeches and look at their ads, and then we're going to fact-check them. We came up with a little gimmick called the Truthometer, where we rate the veracity of statements, and the ratings go from true to mostly true, half true, mostly false, to pants on fire. Well, this little election year project just took off, and today it's a standalone website. It's become a nonprofit newsroom. It's part of the Poynter Institute, which also owns the newspaper. But we're run by journalists. We focus on fact-checking. We do a lot of politics fact-checking. And then as the years went by, social media came around, Facebook and Twitter, and we've spent a lot of time debunking misinformation on social media. And that's what we do. We're trying to get accurate, authoritative information in front of people who want it.
And I love that pants on fire, which, of course, is the highest degree of lack of veracity, right?
That's right. The pants on fire rating means the statement is not accurate and makes a ridiculous claim.
Now, in that case, do you also have to have intent in there? I'm wondering. So what if somebody says something that they believe to be true but in fact isn't? So does pants on fire indicate that the person is willfully lying as well?
That is one of the most interesting questions we grapple with. We try to stay away from intent. So we are just looking at the facts. Our reports, which people can find online, are rundowns of the evidence in favor of the claim or against the claim. So we try not to get bogged down as to whether somebody believes what they're saying or not, because we can't get in people's heads.
Right.
So, yeah. So the pants on fire claims are just things like, this is really wrong. It doesn't mean that the person is like purposefully trying to be deceitful. We just don't know. But we're saying this is ridiculous. This is a ridiculous falsehood.
Yeah. And probably that's wise, because the question of intent is one that, I mean, who knows? And there are multiple intents and there's knowledge on different levels. And so you're not saying we're psychologists. We can see into everybody's motives or how they're thinking or their worldview in which this seems to be true to them. We can only assess what they say specifically.
That's right. We have a process where we look at different buckets of evidence for every claim. I mean, every claim is a little bit different, whether you're talking about, say, taxes or COVID-19. Those are very different topics. But the process is to try and find all the evidence that's available, that's credible, that's authoritative. and then we present it. We have links. We're a little bit unusual in that every story on our site has a long page of sources with links. So we're not asking people to take our word for it. In fact, we encourage them to follow our line of reasoning, to go and check out the links and see for themselves if it's true or not.
What qualifies like a link? For example, let's say you're checking out a story about COVID-19. Maybe it's a story about pregnant women dying at unusual rates from vaccinations. How do you determine whether or not that a story like that is true or not, or has some basis in fact?
For that, we would go and look at what the research papers are showing. And the scientific community is pretty organized around COVID-19 research. So we look at what papers have been published. We look at whether they have been peer-reviewed or not. With COVID-19, we've seen this explosion of studies that are kind of preliminary. So it's scientists trying to share their research with each other, saying like, hey, we saw this, it might be the case, maybe other people can look at it. So we're looking at evidence to see, like, is this just preliminary or has it been peer reviewed? Is it settled? A lot of the things around COVID are pretty interesting because some of it is not settled yet. Some of it they don't know. But as time has gone on, we've seen the science become more and more converging around certain things. So like the vaccines are safe. It's not that nobody has, you know, never had a problem with vaccine, but overall the vaccines seem to be pretty safe. And we've looked into a number of internet claims. Like we have one that we recently checked about a 13-year-old girl in critical care in a hospital in Halifax, Canada. Well, when we go looking for this girl, nobody can find her or knows who she is. And the public health authorities in Canada told us, we don't know who this is. We don't think this person exists. We think, yeah. As you may be surprised to know, people can just make things up on the internet.
That is
so
shocking.
Our job, I know. We spend a lot of our time trying to figure out if things on the internet have a basis in reality or are just made up.
Wow. This sounds like a job that's designed for somebody who really enjoys that game whack-a-mole. You know, you just...
Yeah, you know, it's been really interesting because when I started, we were mostly doing politicians and politics and elections, but the internet and the social media just gave anybody a venue to share information. And the internet is a new technology. The standards are not great on the internet. Anybody can put together a post, and they can put together a post that looks surprisingly professional, like with graphics and headlines, and like they can, that we've documented there are people out there who put together these websites that look like news websites, but they have shocking headlines and everything on them is false. It's a really, it's a strange moment we're in as a society where we have this new technology for communication and sharing information, but people can really game it and just say things that aren't true.
In case you just tuned in, we are talking this morning with Ms. Angie Holin. She is in fact editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. Following up on that, we are all familiar with news stories that are proved to be false or that on examination don't hold together or, as you point out, are complete fabrications. What's the impact of all this on public affairs, public opinion, trust in government, trust in science, in your view?
It's not good. I think that in the time that I've been doing this fact-checking, so since 2007, we've seen the national conversation go from being pretty policy-oriented and fairly fact-based into this kind of free-for-all where people really do think that they can create their own reality or more so, to be just a little bit more charitable to people, they think that if they saw something on the internet from somebody that they like and trust, that means it's true. And it's just not the case. So it's a really, it's a strange time. And we spend a lot of time debunking false claims. And that prevents people from having more productive conversations about what government should do or where society should be headed. It's very unfortunate.
How do you, has anybody tried to measure the impact of all this? Like you, for example, you just indicated that you think that debunking false claims and all this kind of hubbub about things that are not true takes away from true policy discussion. Is there anybody who's doing research that tracks that and says, you know, the amount of policy discussion is dropping, or the people's knowledge about public affairs is dropping, or because of fake news or anything like that?
You know, I'm not aware of that. That would be a fantastic research project. So I'm gonna write that down. One of the problems with misinformation and false news is it's very difficult to measure. So, like, if somebody says something on cable news and it's not true, versus if someone puts out a Facebook post that's not true, versus whether someone has a tweet, like, how do you compare those really different means of communication? It's not like there's a clear metric. There has been some academic research, and I would point to a group at Harvard. They put out a book called Network Propaganda, where they documented false claims moving through the internet and then being spoken on TV, then coming out of the mouths of politicians. And, you know, unfortunately, right now, there's more on the right than on the left. Donald Trump really did say a lot of things that just were not true. And I think the public knew that, because, like, when you look at how Donald Trump polled, like, even among his supporters, his lowest numbers were on honesty. So I think people knew that he was saying things that weren't false. I think some of his supporters just didn't care. They liked his style more. But we do see this kind of information environment where things are said on the internet. They go to cable TV. The politicians pick them up. Sometimes it goes in a different order. But we see these messages moving throughout society. And some of them are accurate, and that's great, but some of them are just wrong. We've spent a lot of the past year fact-checking the inaccurate claims that the election was stolen. And this is one of the claims that really concerns me the most, because if you look at the evidence, it's pretty clear that Joe Biden won in the states that gave him the edge in the Electoral College. He also won the popular vote. Fact checkers have looked again and again at claims that specific cities or specific states had a suitcase full of fake votes. And every time we dig deep into it, there's nothing there. So it really does seem to be like a myth that's being propagated across the country. And we can talk about this some more if you like, but if people don't believe that the elections are fair, that's a huge problem for a democratic government, a big problem, a little democracy. It's a problem in democracy if people don't think the elections are fair.
That is certainly true. One of the things that I was thinking about as you were speaking, there has been some research that suggests that false claims tend to have a longer life and linger long after they've been disproven. That they it's like they create a bad odor in the air and you can't get rid of it. It's still there no matter how much they're refuted. Have you seen a little bit of that? That there's some internet rumors or false stuff that just won't die regardless of how much proof is thrown at it?
Oh, definitely. There's lots of things like that. I think, you know, the election being people saying that it was stolen, I think that's one of those things that we seem to fact check, and people are still saying it because they have political motivations to say it. There have been other claims before that. I want to go to my computer and Google around and look, but mm-hmm. Claims about the economy, claims about social spending. There's a long-standing claim. Here's a good example, where people think that the U.S. spends a lot more on foreign aid than it does. It's actually like a very small percentage of the national budget, but people will say like, oh, it's half. Oh, it's not. Well, no, it's not anywhere near half. But that one is kind of a persistent one, because I think people want to imagine that the government is wasting money. And really, most of the government money, if you look at our stories that break down the U.S. budget, most of the U.S. money is going to spending on citizens, specifically Medicare, that's health care for older people, Social Security, that's retirement money for older people, and Medicaid, which is health care for the poor and the disabled. So it's not going to foreign aid.
I think the figure I heard on foreign aid, the actual fact-based figure, some is 1.5% of the federal budget is going to something that could be called foreign aid. It's a very tiny percentage, whereas those three, if you throw defense in there, you've got, you know, 80% of the budget. So definitely you're right about that. The stolen election, you know, one of the things that's interesting, I think, and we've all experienced this, is that people have found that their families are, in fact, and people they know are people who are spreading these kind of fake news stories. And I think for many of us, there's been a real scratching our head about how is it possible that someone that I knew could believe something like that? So do you ever find yourself incredulous, or have you noticed fake news in your circles or people you go, wait a minute, or are you guys immune to that since you are the fact checkers?
You know, it's funny. I have fewer conversations about politics than I used to. And I think there is a sense around the country that people do not want to talk about politics because it just seems to get hot immediately. So there's all this vitriolic arguments on the internet, but in person, I can't tell you how many times people have said, oh, let's not talk about politics. Or like, I don't want to talk about politics. And I would say that's a societal harm as well. I mean, if we can't have, you know, civil conversations around politics, that's a big problem. Now, PolitiFact has done some stories going in depth on how people get sucked into conspiracy theories and hoaxes. We've done a lot of looking at the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, where people really believed that the election had been stolen, and so their response was to invade the Capitol. Some of these people were very deep into the world of conspiracy theories, QAnon. I don't know how many people are familiar with the QAnon conspiracy, but it's a really bizarre one. I won't get into all the details, but suffice to say that people who get into this, a lot of times we have found they have suffered some sort of trauma in their lives. So maybe a loved one has died, or they got a divorce. And so I do think that if the listeners out there have family or friends who are into this, I do think compassion is a good response, because clearly some of these people are finding some sort of psychological comfort in the conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And what we found is that, like, a journalist is not going to talk anybody out of believing in a conspiracy theory, but a friend or a family member might. And the key is just to say, like, to start really calmly and in a friendly way and say, tell me more about why you think this, and get them talking and make them feel heard. And then just, like, very gently say, like, you know, well, I heard something different. You know, is it possible that this isn't right? And see if they're open to that. And they might even say, like, no, you're wrong. But it could plant a seed. I mean, these things are very. They go to people's their personal beliefs, their sense of belonging, their sense of safety. So there's a lot of subtle communication methods here that are at work.
You know, there's so many claims. There's so many spurious claims. By the way, we're talking today with the editor-in-chief of PolitiFact, Ms. Angie Holin. There's so many spurious claims and things that pop up on the internet. How do you pick which ones to fact check? I'm assuming that you have limited resources because you live in the real world and you have to think about funding and people's time and those sorts of things. So, and the process you describe about fact checking, providing all the sources, going and looking at the research and doing that takes time. So how do you pick which ones to go after?
Well, we try to pick the ones that are going viral, as we say. And that means that it's misinformation, it's spreading very quickly, it's becoming more popular. We have a couple of tools to help us determine which ones are going viral. PolitiFact is one of several fact checkers that has a partnership with Facebook, where Facebook gives us access to the posts that are suspicious and spreading quickly, and so we fact check those. We've also have our history fact-checking elections. So we're always looking to fact-check things that are in politics and that people may be hearing. We generally look for things that sound wrong and would make the average person say, I wonder if that's true. And then after that, we look for a diversity of topics. and look for what's in the news.
Well, now you just mentioned your partnership with Facebook, but in fact, some of the big Facebook seems to be one of the spots that is most subject to these kind of crazy rumors, and in fact has been blamed by many people for not interceding more forcefully with people who are spreading these crazy rumors. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think Facebook has gotten a lot of criticism, and justifiably so, for what its algorithms do. Its algorithms seem kind of keyed to promote things that are inflammatory or upsetting because people have emotional reactions and then they engage with the content. I think YouTube is just as bad in that respect. In some ways, I think all of the social media have problems. I do like the partnership with Facebook, though, because before the partnership, we would get messages from our readers saying, hey, I saw this thing on Facebook. Is this true or not? And we were relying on people to send us the content. And that's not always easy for everyday users.
All right. We're talking with PolitiFacts editor-in-chief, Ms. Angie Holin. I was going to ask you if, in fact, you had a nightmare scenario, some kind of incident that you doubt the ability of any PolitiFact or any other fact-checking service to keep up with, but it's possible that the election or something like that has already happened. Is that the worst thing that could possibly happen, or is there something else?
I have to say,
go ahead.
I think elections are one of the areas of biggest concern right now. It's one of my concerns, and I'm not the only one. There was an essay recently in the Washington Post by Robert Kagan talking about the harm that false claims about a stolen election can do, because if people really believe that the election was stolen, then the next election comes and they say, well, we're going to steal it this time because they did it to us first. And that's a huge nightmare scenario. It goes straight to the heart of democracy. It's incredibly dangerous. So those are kind of where my concerns lie right now. And if we avert this sort of crisis, it won't be very dramatic. We'll just be like, oh, well, we had a normal election, and that would be great. And I hope that that is what happens. I think the fear is that will our next elections be free and fair? I think there's a lot of anxiety that people on different sides have about that.
Well, that's certainly true, given that I saw a headline today saying that it's almost certain that Donald Trump is going to run for reelection again, which, of course, one would think would heighten the kind of rumors that surrounded the last two elections. So I promised that I would give you a chance to ask a question or to talk about politics a little bit. We got a couple minutes left. Go for it.
Yeah, my question for you is, I watch politics and things seem very polarized with Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other. But in Louisiana, there are some of the politicians who do seem to maybe not cross lines, but seem to defy categories. So the examples I would throw out to you are Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat but a conservative one, and Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, who seems willing to work with Democrats. What's your view of the polarization of politics right now? Are there more Edwards and Cassidys than we know of, or do you think they're exceptional people who just happen to hold office right now?
Well, I think it's... I think that's a complicated question. I mean, with John Bel Edwards, he is who he is, and he's a fairly conservative Southern politician who happens to be a Democrat. He's certainly pro-gun, pro-life, but he's also centrist in a number of areas and kind of a rational guy who will make a deal when he feels like principles aren't really at stake. So he's certainly not an ideologue in the sense that we have gotten used to AOC and the Squad or the progressive view of who Democrats are. Another thing to remember is that Democrats in Louisiana are a majority Black party. The majority of Democrats in Louisiana are African-American. African-Americans are, on a lot of social issues, less progressive than white Democrats across the country. So he has a built-in, his Democratic constituency is built-in a little bit more conservative than it is, say, in California or Massachusetts. Moving on to Bill Cassidy. Cassidy was quite a moderate back when he was a state senator. He was a doctor. He got into politics a little bit late. He had always seemed to be kind of a reasonable, moderate kind of person. He abandoned that a little bit in order to win backing from the Republicans in his race against Mary Landrieu. Once he won that race, he has tread the line, but he's also, particularly since he's been elected a second time, indicated that he's willing to, you know, act as his own person, and he's not going to be held hostage by the kind of shibboleths of political action on the right. So he has shown more flexibility. Of course, many people, me included, have speculated that this means that Mr. Cassidy is going to be content with being a two-term Republican if he continues to do things like, you know, vote that Trump should be impeached or there should be investigation of the January 6th incident. He's probably going to get primaried from the right. But it could be that he's okay with that. He's saying, look, I'm going to do the right thing as long as I'm there. So that's my take. I think they're two specific individuals. I think the partisan divide in Louisiana is, with the one exception I mentioned, of African-Americans in Louisiana not being quite as conservative, quite as liberal, is pretty much the same as in other states.
Interesting. And what do you think John Bel Edwards' future in politics is?
Well, you know, that's one of the really interesting things is if you're a Democrat in Louisiana, it's very easy to top out at whatever position. It's pretty unlikely that he could win a Senate seat. If another Democrat got elected nationally, he might be able to do what Cedric Richmond did and go on to work in a Democratic administration. Another person who's kind of topped out, of course, would be Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans. So in both of those cases, you see someone who unlikely to be elected to a statewide office in Louisiana right now, and hence has kind of reached the end for moving up the political ladder. Well, we've been talking this morning with Ms. Angie Holin, who is, in fact, editor-in-chief of PolitiFact, and I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about PolitiFact, and I'm sure we all feel better knowing that there are people like you out there who are dispelling rumors and untruths.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great to be here.
Bayou de Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org. krvs.org.
Join KRVS on October 6th at 7:30 p.m. for Cypress Lake Studios Live, a monthly streaming concert series presented by the Dr. Tommy Como Endowed Chair in Traditional Music at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Each concert is recorded live at KRVS's Cypress Lake Studios and streamed to the world. This concert will feature Blake Miller and the Old Fashioned Aces, the Marty Christian Blues Trio, and Jeffrey Broussard and the Creole Cowboys. Register for free on our website, krvs.org.
Later today on This American Life, we asked for your embarrassing stories, just because we thought it'd be fun. Over 1,000 of you wrote in, including Mary, who MacGyvered a corset out of saran wrap to help her squeeze into a bridesmaid's dress, which did not go as planned.
And I'm looking down at the floor, and I'm seeing spots. And I'm a fainter, so I know what that means.
Our embarrassing stories, later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.